You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Professor Stephen Hawking and other scientists believe that to secure the future of the human species, we must colonize another planet.
To stay risks annihilation. It could be an asteroid hitting the Earth. It could be a new virus, climate change, nuclear war, artificial intelligence gone rogue. We can, and must, use our curiosity and intelligence to look to the stars. We must do it now before humanity is overtaken by some disaster that we can neither anticipate nor control.
Call it long-termism or effective altruism, but get ready for a ride. Big names like physicist Stephen Hawking and Elon Musk boost the cause. It sounds good at the start. We owe a duty to future humans and all intelligent life from animals to the octopus. In an apparently barren galaxy, we must at all costs prevent extinction of intelligent life on Earth. To do that, says Oxford philosopher Nick Bostrom, humans will merge with artificial intelligence, becoming transhuman. That new life form must spread beyond this planet to populate other worlds. Bostrom catalogs the most dire threats from nuclear war through climate change to genetic tampering. Others get on board, like the Australian philosopher Toby Ord and astronomer Royal Sir Martin Rees. Millions of dollars flow in from tech moguls like Bill and Melinda Gates and Peter Thiel. New institutions are founded, such as Oxford's Center for the Study of Existential Risk and the Future of Life Institute at the University of Cambridge. That is where we start, at the bottom of a foggy future where post-humans inhabit a technical utopia in the stars. Is it real? Is it helpful or harmful to us right now? Toby Ord, author of the influential book The Precipice, told me he is too busy with other projects to appear on Radio EcoShock. Nick Bostrom's assistant says he is on leave until end of January. Bostrom is author of Superintelligence: Paths, Dangers, Strategies. Our audience is probably too small for him anyway. So we depend on two critics with views on ecology, justice, and what it means to be human, where we are, as we are. Canadian academics Joshua Schuster and Derek Woods just published their book Calamity Theory, Three Critiques of Existential Risk. Dr. Schuster is author of The Ecology of Modernism, American Environments and Avant-Garde Poetics. He is currently on sabbatical in France. From Paris, Joshua Schuster, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me.
How did this existential risk movement begin?
Well, mostly it's attributed to a specific philosopher named Nick Bostrom, who's a philosopher at Oxford University. It's about two decades old, and it's a movement really just to think, what are the possible end scenarios for humanity and for the planet?
And this school of deep future thinkers may be influencing corporate and political leaders, maybe even military planners. Why are big threats like climate change or genocide demoted, made less important in their view?
I should go back a little bit and say, yes, when existential risk theory really started taking off, it became very popular among a lot of well-known technocratic elites, especially Elon Musk. Bill Gates is interested in it. Jan Tallinn, the founder of Skype, and many others. And that already asks the reason, why is it so popular with that kind of audience? But as you said, also, it's popular with like defense planning. I've seen the United Nations people using this kind of language. And one obvious reason is it's very technologically friendly and very sort of, let's say, top down friendly, where the decisions might get made by a set of elites who are capable of manipulating technology or political systems very effectively. But it is not a bottom up movement. It's not a grassroots movement, intellectual or sort of social justice movement or environmental justice movement. And that's one of the main critiques we have of it. So it really views sort of disastrous scenarios that people are generally familiar with, things like nuclear warfare, runaway climate change, artificial intelligence going haywire, things like bad actors using nanotechnology or biowarfare or stuff like that. So these are all very, very important issues, no doubt. And philosophers should have something to say about that. But the methods matter, the ways we talk about these matter. And we need to include everyone. And so it should be a democratic thing. It shouldn't be a technological solution or a top-down solution.
Well, I stopped in the body shop. Said to the guy, I want stereo FM installed in my teeth. Then take this mole off my back and put it on my cheek. And while I'm here, why don't you give me some of those high-heeled feet? And he said, listen, there's no guarantee.
And I think we're going to have to lay one of the groundwork parts of this, because one of the founders of this, Nick Bostrom, who's a Swedish philosopher now at Oxford, was first known for promoting how he would like to become a transhuman. What does it mean to be transhuman, and why, in Nick Bostrom's view, are we obligated to go there?
Sure, yeah. So these are actually closely connected in Bostrom's mind, the idea that we should study existential risk and the idea that we should tend towards transhumanism. And transhumanism means just the enhancement of the physical body or the mind towards better and better and longer lasting and more capable capacities and using technology to do that. The idea, one of the main reasons they're linked is because if we are able to enhance ourselves, maybe we can control some of these existential risks and we either be smarter about them or more morally, let's say, embedded or technologically capable of stopping some of these problems. So the idea would be existential risk should favor these kinds of what might be called super technologies, and they will help us in the long run. And that's why it's an obligation, because otherwise we're going to be stuck with these existential risks because they won't go away.
To put it on a ground level, are we talking about maybe importing Wikipedia into our brains so we don't have to look at our phone all the time? I mean, it would be exciting to have eyes that could focus like telescopes at will, that kind of sci-fi stuff. Josh, would you accept body modifications, and will we need them to compete with those who do?
Well, I'm not anti-technological, and I certainly think technology will help us. I mean, we won't make it through this energy transition, which is not just in terms of fossil fuels, but it's a whole cultural transition, a sort of planetary transition. We need the technology, there's no doubt. But we need a lot more than that. We need forms of collaboration and better democracies and more art and more education and so on. There's a lot of ways we can go forward. I mean, I don't mind, you know, being able to download a lot of information, but the funny thing is you can just Google it anyways, right? You don't need the whole Wikipedia in your brain to be a better human. One of the complaints we have with someone like Nick Bostrom and existential risk movements is that so many of the utopian things, the science fiction scenarios that you just suggested, so many of those are already available to us. We have basically all information, you know, at our fingertips, and we have time to write books if we want, or to do other things like save the planet. Right? There's nothing stopping us. So in fact, we don't need the massive technological upgrades that they think that we do.
In your book, Calamity Theory, you and Derek Woods take issue with the narrow definition of existential in existential risk, and it's at the foundation of Bostrom's proposal. What's the problem there?
So we were quite surprised that actually no one really involved in the existential risk movement, and there are other philosophers, by the way, most notably Sir Martin Rees, who's a scientist as well. So just the handful of philosophers out there who are interested in this field in particular don't really examine the term existential at all. They are not existential thinkers, and they're not interested at all in that field. We are, however, we're not sort of card-carrying existentialist members, but we're interested in the philosophy and what we can learn from it. And I do think it has a lot to tell us today. And we argue that it really just starts from being an embodied, precarious being among others. So not just humans, but animals, of course, and plants. And that embodiment matters. So we're not just talking about like abstract math or logic here. To have a body in a specific time and place is a key starting point for what knowledge and philosophy is. And that's the basis of existential thought. Furthermore, existential thought is engaged in thinking about big sort of things that confront existence, like mortality, or sometimes called finitude in existential philosophy. And it says that the life and death of the thinker matter. That makes a difference in philosophy. And it's something that needs to have a thought, a method, an engagement, an interpretation, and all that together will be guidelines for living together and sharing each other's sort of existential space.
Well, let's just suppose an allegiance of large computing develops and a global artificial intelligence emerges, and eventually that machine-based system survives a global threat that demolishes animal life. Who or what is left to experience being alive? And are Bostrom and his allies thinking that we could create a lifeboat that would just keep knowledge alive even if we don't make it?
That's certainly a scenario that some of them entertain. I mean, I don't think they see that as a promising scenario, but it could be a possible or plausible one. You still need resources to build these machines and, you know, a place to have them, let's say an environment where they function. So you still need that, you know, basic ecological means for any of this to make sense. So I don't even believe the scenario where it's sort of you just get uploaded and problems are solved. There are virtual ecologies. There are physical ecologies. We need to be good at doing ecology. And being good at doing ecology means sharing the planet with other life forms, being biosymbiotic. And a planet that doesn't have that is in big trouble, you know, whether or not it's technically advanced. And I would just add one further complication to this, which is that, I mean, to me, true knowledge and, let's say, a better society, you know, includes multiple forms of life. It's not just about having, you know, fancy machines. So if we think that we're enhancing ourselves by sort of, you know, destroying the planet towards some form of superintelligence, no, that's a loss. That's not a gain.
I remember reading back in 1989, the British comedian Ben Elton published his book Stark. And while Earth goes to a hell, sounding pretty much like today, the ultra wealthy and their bankers and people plot to get away in a spaceship looking for a new home. And that was ironic science fiction. But tell us about the grand vision Nick Bostrom deploys as the real goal and duty of humanity.
So, you know, the scenario you described does sound like the playbook for someone like Elon Musk, who is definitely a big fan and leader of Nick Bostrom. Bostrom himself, I'm not sure if that's something that he's in favor of, but Bostrom certainly wants superintelligence and artificial intelligence to be escalated. And he hopes that that is something that is accomplished in the near future. Towards the end, that would be that people would have much longer lives. Perhaps, as Ray Kurzweil says, you would live long enough to live forever. In other words, mortality itself wouldn't be a problem anymore because our physical or mental capacities are so enhanced that there's no more fatality. So these are all, you know, fantasies maybe or utopian horizons. And I think the job of someone like myself, I'm not convinced that that's actually as utopian as it sounds, but also that we should come up with better utopias too and make those convincing as well.
Well, we're looking at a lot of faces that have joined this movement, but to be blunt, the whole crowd looks to me like white capitalist men. Many of them are located at the former helm of colonialist power in Britain. Josh, do you suppose that influences their view of priorities for humanity?
I definitely think the existential risk field itself should be more diverse, and it certainly, methodologically, it doesn't have to be just white men. There's different kinds of, let's say, think tanks, we could call them, out there. There's one called the Center for the Study of Existential Risk at Cambridge University, and they certainly have a diverse number of people working there. So it's possible to bring it in the right directions, but it's still a question of the philosophy itself, the method, and the main ideas. They themselves need to be more. To me, things like a white capitalist idea is to make decisions for other people, right? Rather than consent and consultation and participation and democracy. It's to sort of, you know, build something and say, you're going to have to, it's now compulsory. You have no choice. I think there's ways that the methods and the science and the technology itself can be more shared and shareable, more participatory. And to me, that's the better utopian horizon. But I don't see them building that in their ideas. And I don't see them building it in the technology. You know, Elon Musk is not building in a participatory form of car or solar panel. You know, he gains the profits and that's the model.
But Nick Bostrom, he does call us to value future life and not just humans, but all intelligent life. So I think some environmentalists can agree with that. So not just to act as though, well, as once we're gone, nothing matters. He's saying, well, once we're gone, a lot matters. And we have a duty to the future and to future people and their happiness.
Yeah. So there's a kind of related movement called long-termism that's become popular as well. as well as another somewhat related movement called effective altruism. And someone like Peter Singer, a well-known ethical philosopher, is involved in that. And all of these arguments sort of borrow from each other. And they do think that, yeah, it's important to have what they would call utilitarian values of happiness that are spread to as many people as possible, as well as to future generations. So on the face of it, that sounds very utopian, that we would have all this happiness and much more happiness in the future if technology can grant it to us, you know, in a fair way. But on the other hand, I'm not so sure, you know, when they say that, you know, happiness is something you can calculate and sort of quantify, and future generations, they might be in the billions and so on. Suddenly you get in this model in which you're already, again, buying into this technological salvationism. When I think, again, technology can help us, but we can already share the planet. We can already enjoy each other's company. We already can be a lot happier than we are. We can already do a lot more in terms of sharing and enjoying and playing together and making art. And none of that, again, requires, in my opinion, utilitarian philosophy or technology or enhancements or anything like that. And finally, you know, all this is about future generations too. And I think one of the major duties we have is to bequeath a future that isn't in debt to us. Financially, you know, climate-wise, they shouldn't be in debt to the choices that we made. But I also want to say existentially, if we made choices in terms of who we are existentially, like now, you know, we've all upgraded ourselves, future generations won't have that choice. They'll be required to follow our decisions. To me, that's thinking about future generations means letting them have those existential choices too.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex with our guest, author and assistant professor Joshua Schuster. We're talking about radical long-termism and his new book with Derek Woods, Calamity Theory, Three Critiques of Existential Risk. So yes, your book offers three critiques of existential risk, and these are deep, they're well explained, but they're not really easy to boil down, but let's give it a bit of a shot. Could you outline your first major criticism of the existential risk movement?
Okay, so we do take issue with some of the basic definitional terms that Nick Bostrom and others are using for existential risk. Bostrom himself famously says an existential risk has to be total, means that there has to be full extinction. So other catastrophes, things like world wars or pandemics or genocide even, these won't count as existential risks because they weren't total. And we already think that that's ridiculous. Why does that version of the definition need to be the standard for existential risk? So we question his first definition right from the outset. The other major critique we have in that first chapter is that Bostrom himself, actually, although he's a philosopher and he's very smart about how to use philosophy, he doesn't actually do much, let's say, philosophizing. He's very good at making lists and coming up with summaries and scenarios and very quick, brief definitions and typologies, we call it. But he doesn't actually have many conversations with other philosophers or do much citation or do much, let's say, more dialogical work in philosophy. And we think that's a big problem in his ideas and in the field generally.
Your second critique investigates the use of mathematics and probability theory employed by Bostrom and others to link with solid science. With these theories of existential risk, are we dealing with science really or belief?
Yeah, that's a great question. So that's something that my colleague Derek Woods would be much better answering than I. And I'm thankful for Derek and how we collaborated together on this book. But I think the question is definitely, you know, about how much, let's say, probability or science is really going on in these estimations for existential risks. These philosophers would like to view themselves as scientifically correct and accurate, or defending a form of scientific approach to these problems, these catastrophic problems. And in that sense, they sort of distance themselves from the humanities, and they hopefully have the ear of, you know, technologists and mathematicians and other sort of policymakers by using the language of science. But so science, we think, should include things like science fiction, other humanities tools, speculation, creative speculation, utopian building, different forms of conversations and collaborations across the fields of the arts and sciences. So science doesn't boil down to this kind of rational calculation or a statistical view of what form of disaster might happen here or there. It should be much more broad-based.
And I'm still learning about all this. I'm reading Toby Ord's book, The Precipice, but So far, it looks to me that apparently humanity as we know it cannot be saved. We are completely obligated to transform ourselves into a new species, and then we can enter a utopia that lasts a billion years on a billion planets. It sounds so much like a New Age religion or even an old messianic text of heaven and hell. Do you and Derek get a religious feel from this group and these ideas?
Yeah, absolutely. Many of them do have that kind of, you could call it secular messianism, because it's not a belief that a God will save someone, but that sort of technology will. And yeah, but this kind of thinking draws from this longer history of salvationism. And it's not something that Derek and I think is the right way forward by any means. We're much more interested in, you know, the fields of the humanities and science working together, you know, step by step through things like consent and consultation and dialogue and sharing both the benefits and the burdens of living on the planet together. You know, we don't need these almost impossible utopias to make some progress. And I don't think those are the most reasonable utopias to imagine. I think we can do better in our utopian thinking. I also think we can do better in our dystopian thinking, because to me, constantly thinking about the most dystopian scenarios, that in itself is pretty dystopian.
Well, okay. So how powerful do you think the existential risk crowd has become in real world decision making?
I think they are quite popular and they're growing. They are very popular in Silicon Valley, and that, you know, field has a massive amount of power, we could say, and attention these days. Just, it's important to do this philosophy. It's important to have these critiques. I think the field should welcome these critiques. They shouldn't think that they don't need some form of critique and wider engagement. You know, there should be a way forward. There's many great ideas. Bostrom is quite smart about some of his approach to the field, and it's helpful to have someone like that to question and challenge. But the field shouldn't be just the reserve of the technological elite. I personally think, I mean, the only right philosophy is one that includes everyone on the planet and engages them and has their well-being and their flourishing in mind. And to me, that's what existential philosophy is, and that's why it's different than existential risk.
The system proposed by Bostrom and Ord, and it's supported by the late Stephen Hawking and other English-speaking luminaries, as you mentioned, to me it sounds a little bit like Plato's Republic. The low-class producers and auxiliaries will always be disposable as long as the guardians survive. What do you think?
Yeah, I hope it's not that kind of the 1% that get to live in the ideal city or that run the city in Plato's view. Again, the only ideal city for me is one where everyone's running it together. That's the true definition of democracy. So we have to make social forms and technological forms that can do that. I don't know. We don't maybe have the technologies yet, or we don't even have the language yet, or the stories, or the philosophies that will let us do that together. And again, it's not just humans sharing the planet. It's, you know, all forms of life doing this together. But that's a real project. That just means that everyone, you know, there's a lot to think and a lot to do. And I'm excited for that. And I'm, you know, hopeful in that sense. To me, the scenarios where it's just a small sliver of people who succeed and the rest, you know, are just disappearing somehow. And some, you know, already that's extremely dystopian. And how people disappear, that won't go well. So there's no place for Plato. That city doesn't go well at all.
Well, we may enter a time when any alienated person can make a killer gene in their basement. We may have to have cameras in every basement. So would it be okay to accept global fascism if that's what it takes to survive? And would that still fit in with this picture of existential risk?
Yeah, I mean, that's a key question. I've seen people talk a lot about that kind of scenario thinking, where surveillance or control somehow becomes the only thing that can prevent someone from doing some terrible act, especially as technology gets more advanced. I can't imagine any technology that would actually work that well, you know, that wouldn't create its own other additional problems. I don't see that total surveillance as an option whatsoever. I think any philosophy that ends up saying that's the only option is, you know, not a great philosophy, and we can do better. To me, it misses the fundamental thing, which is people should be encouraged to enjoy each other's presence or share the planet. It sounds, you know, maybe a little naive or way too optimistic, but to me, I think people are more likely to do terrible things when they don't feel included, or they don't feel heard, or they don't feel like their life is part of a pathway towards flourishing. So that just means we should do better work on the existential side of things, not necessarily the technological side. But when people feel welcome and included and shared, it's just a better world, and it's a safer world. So maybe reducing existential risk, the best way forward is to develop those kinds of collective practices.
And that doesn't fit on Bostrom's list of the most extreme things.
No, and that solution doesn't fit on his either, because again, they think, you know, technology is the only likely scenario we have going forward, some form of technological security.
Well, maybe you and Derek are just old school thinkers stuck in the past, like those green groups who want to save the old natural world. Do you oppose technology?
No, again, I don't. You know, I would already say, you know, everyday life is very technological. We don't need to dismiss the importance of technology, and it'll help us share things and work together and collaborate and learn about each other. So technology is helpful. We just don't need what we could say is like a cult of technology, where we think it's going to solve all of our problems and that it has all the answers. And in fact, it'll do philosophy for us. Somehow, if we can program the machines, the machines will do philosophy for us, and we'll be done with philosophy. But I think that, to me, is the worst scenario, because I don't think philosophy is ever done or finished, and that it's all about a participatory kind of endless practice of thinking and thinking together. So we can use technology in a more playful way going forward than this sort of kind of aggressive, kind of both utopian, dystopian way that we're headed for at this point.
Do you think environmentalists should be attracted or nervous about long-termism? Is it an ally or a threat? What are your views?
I think so much depends on, you know, what that phrase will mean and how it gets defined. And I think this is the opportunity for everyone to sort of talk about it and make criticisms and revisions. But of course, we should think long-term. You know, deep time is another phrase. But it's not long-termism just for humans or for intelligent humans. It's for everybody. Evolution itself is a form of long-term thinking. And long-term thinking also connects to, you know, how can we share the most we can with it, with, you know, the most people out there. And maybe things like universal basic income is the right way forward. I would just add, you know, things like universal basic play or universal basic, you know, food and water. But I would even say, you know, transportation, bicycles, universal basic bicycles, universal basic community participation. These kinds of things are as important as the technological fantasies that seem to occupy so many people.
As we wrap up here, is there anything else you'd like to talk about with our listeners?
Well, I hope I've given a convincing criticism of the existential risk movement, and our book adds to the conversation in a helpful way. I still remain pretty optimistic. One of the kind of quick summaries I have of this book is that, so I think we need a lot of change in terms of what I would call ecological content, things like solar panels and electric cars and renewable fuel technologies and so on. So that would be ecological content. But we need a lot of ecological form too, things like sharing and participating together and consulting and using philosophy and using art and finding ways of sharing the planet together. So that's what I call ecological form. So I think the book says that we need, you know, ecological form or existential form as much as we need these things like content going forward. And I hope that, you know, that's a way forward for a lot of people to start to be included in these conversations.
We've been speaking with Dr. Joshua Schuster. He's an associate professor at Western University in London, Canada. Schuster and Derek Woods from the University of British Columbia just published their book, Calamity Theory, Three Critiques of Existential Risk. You can find links to follow up on this discussion in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Josh, thank you for spending some good time with us.
Thanks, Alex. Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Ships lying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one.